Hello and welcome. The following lecture you are about to listen to is a lecture given by Gaetan Heroux on November 9th at the University of Toronto, the Sid Smith Building. Gaetan Heroux, of course, is a well-known activist with the Ontario Coalition Against Poverty, and the subject of his lecture will be Indigent Workers and Capitalist Crisis in Toronto from 1830 to 1930, approximately. And I hope you enjoy it as much as we did. Thank you.
Workers, indigent labor, and capitalist crisis in Toronto is the topic. And the period is, I can't remember,
1930.
So 100-year period almost. And the talk is going to be based on the joint work research done by Gaetan Heroux, who's here with us today, and Professor Brian Palmer, who unfortunately cannot be with us today. Gaetan Heroux is well known to Toronto urban activists because he has been an activist on a number of issues in Toronto for a very long time, especially with the Ontario Coalition Against Poverty, OCAP. And in addition, he was also the Bousfield Distinguished Visitor in Planning last year with us. And I'm, as the one-time director of the planning program, I'm especially happy to have been able to support Gaetan on the important research that he has been doing over the years, including his joint work with Dr. Brian Palmer that he's going to talk about today. You know, our Bousfield visitorship was particularly to support his research that he's going to talk about today. And for those of you who don't know Professor Brian Palmer, he is Professor of History and Canadian Studies at Trent University, also holds a Canada Research Chair at Trent. And he's, you know, I think briefly and best described as one of the leading left labor historians in Canada and in the world today. Okay. So he's written, for some of us will be familiar with this work, an important book on the perhaps even more famous, English historian E.P. Thompson. And the latest thing I've seen of Brian Palmer is a review of a book on the history of anarchism in the colonial and post-colonial world. And this you can find in the latest review of the latest edition of the issue of the one of my favorite journals, for people who know me, New Left Review. So Gaetan, welcome.
So I just want to start by thanking the planning department and U of T for the support in the last year. It's been very helpful in terms of being able to do this kind of work. We're still living off of that money right now, actually. So now, Brian can't be here today. He had planned to be here, and he's not going to be here. Now, despite the title, Capitalism is a Crisis, I'm not going to use the word capitalism once during my talk. And the whole issue of capitalism as crisis, I think for me, Brian is better placed to discuss. Although if during the discussion we want to enter that territory, we can enter that territory. I have no problems with it. There is a paper that was written for people who are interested in labor, le travail, that will take that argument. It's quite well argued, in my opinion. And given the time period that we have, it'd be hard for me, and I'm actually not as well placed as Brian to. And originally, if we'd agreed that he would talk about that, and I would talk about the other aspect of the argument, which is unemployed in Toronto organizing during the or before the Great Depression. So, the talk actually is again. the talk will focus in part, the first part, on some of the material in the paper, which is unemployed organizing around the labor test, or cracking stone, in Toronto But I'm actually going to talk about two other things, which is material that hasn't been published yet that covers stuff during the Great Depression. In particular, the York relief strike in 1936. And if we have time, if people are willing, a couple of examples of evictions being stopped in East York during the Great Depression. So those are the three things I'm aiming to talk about. The first two, hopefully, we'll get through for sure. The second one, I'm not sure if people want to talk about it. If people feel they want to hear it, then we'll make a decision. I'm going to have to take off my glasses. I can't see anybody, but it helps me read. I want to frame the talk, however, with this quote. In the spring of 1816, there were food riots in England. And as a result of that, people were hung, people were deported, people were literally starving. And during one of these demonstrations in Upwell, a large crowd was moving towards the town, and a rector stopped the demonstration. And these are the words of William Dawson to the rector. And by the way, the slogan that they were working under during that time was bread or blood. And this was William Dawson's answer to the rector. He said, "Here I am between earth and sky, so help me God. I would sooner lose my life than go home as I am. Bread I want, and bread I shall have." So I wanted to use this to frame the talk, and we'll go back to this quote at the end of the talk. So, Cracking Stone. So the context for Cracking Stone is the House of Industry. Toronto's first poorhouse was established in 1837. It dominated the lives of poor people for almost a century. Its main function had three main functions. Its first was it served as a residence. It also distributed outdoor relief to families who were poor in the city. By that, I mean they gave out food and coal and that kind of stuff. And also, it had a casual ward where vagrants were sheltered and given food. To give you a sense of why the House of Industry was established, there was a meeting that happened near the end of December 1936, and one of the people who I assume attended the meeting, B. Turkin, who was an employee of the Bank of Canada, said the chief objects of establishing a poorhouse was the total abolition of street begging, the putting down of wandering vagrants, and securing an asylum for an asylum at the least possible expense for the industrious and distressed poor. These objects are highly deserving and essential to the comfort and happiness of the community. And actually, at that meeting, they actually outlawed begging. There was extreme discrimination and prejudices against the poor back then. There was a big debate also throughout that period and onwards around the whole issue of offering charity or services to the poor. So, and this debate was ongoing in 1874, for instance. This appeared in the Globe. Promiscuous arms giving is fatal. It is the patent process for the manufacture of paupers out of the worthless and improvident. A poor law is a legislative machine for the manufacture of pauperism. It is true mercy to say that it would be better that a few individuals should die of starvation than a pauper class should be raised up with thousands devoted to crime and the victims of misery. Again, the context of the Breaking Stone and the House of Industry has to be understood also in the context that in 1873, and for the next two decades, there was a worldwide recession, which meant many, many, many people were unemployed. Many, many people were forced to beg on the streets. In 1880, a group formed called the Combined City Charities. So you had the House of Industry on one side, Combined City Charities on the other side, which would have been the equivalent, like St. Paul's, a whole bunch of charities that were in Toronto. Its three main goals, this is in spring of 1880, to discourage pauperism in every way in the city and to use every legislative means to prevent paupers from the country district making the city their resort for assistance, that idlers and impostors and able-bodied vagabonds may be exposed and punished, to promote a more careful and vigorous investigation into cases of alleged wants of distress. Again, this is in the middle of recession, worldwide recession that's going on. So the first, one of the first examples of actually the of unemployed having to crack stone was with related to the combined city of charities. And they worked with the House of Industry. And what they did is they set up a stone yard. And this is a report, 1883, from the Combined City of Charities in terms of about their feelings about the stone yard. It says, this winter, the stone yard has proved a blessing in getting rid of the tramps and others whose lay it is to say that they are extremely willing to work but can't get work to do. Several hundred of these frauds, when introduced to a pile of stone and a hammer, recollect that they are not at all proficient in stone breaking and decline to work at it. The great value of this is that the charitables are not pestered by these men again, and they have no difficulty of disposing of them. Again, this extreme prejudice that existed there and discrimination that was there. I think that lasted for about 3 years. At that point, people were given a little bit of money for breaking the stones, but obviously it was very, very hard to. In 1885, the house industry established a casual ward. In the end, the purpose of the casual ward was to enforce a labor test. At first, the labor test they introduced was the cutting of wood. This is a description from 1887 of the conditions in the House of Industry, the Wayfarers Lodge. Have any of our readers ever looked into the casual wards of the House of Industry of this city after 9:30 in the evening? The casual wards referred to are not models of comfort. They are not provided with beds of any kind. They are kept warm and clean, but the hard boards on the floors are all they have for beds, and a range of boards a little raised for pillows. There is a combination for about 120 to 130, that is to say, there is floor room for such. Last Saturday night, there were 125, and there was nothing abnormal about the number. They were lying as thickly packed as herring in a barrel. One could scarcely move without stepping on them, perhaps about 30 to 40 in each apartment, all lying as best as they could on the hard boards. And who were they all that thus crowd this ward? Mostly young men. One of the key players in the house industry, who's a trustee for the house industry, was actually Reverend Baldwin, Arthur Baldwin, who actually was the reverend at All Saints Church, which still stands today. And he was a trustee of the House of Industry, and this was his position on the question of vagrants. I do not see how we can get rid of them if we continue to give them charity. To keep them in comfortable quarters, the quarters we just heard about, which he was responsible for, to allow them to live in idleness is not the way to get rid of them. The history of England shows how, in the past, such men would not work if by any means they could depend upon others for their support. But when the work test was applied, there was no encouragement for them to become paupers. Now, the house industry set up its casual ward, and they were cutting wood, but it appeared to them that it wasn't enough. So in a report that happened in the early 1890s, the board said, until the vagrant is offered an alternative to that even he will recognize as more unpleasant and disagreeable than work, the board argued the tramp trouble will never be cured. So they were feeling that whatever was there wasn't sufficient, it wasn't deterring them enough. And as a result of that, they introduced the policy of having to break stone for your relief, not just to the casuals, but also to all people who were, even people who were heads of family who were receiving relief for their relief for their families. Now, at this point, for me, what really really interests me is what was the reaction of the unemployed and the men in the city to this. So, in their report, in the first clue that something that they didn't agree with this was in their report, 1895-1896 report, which stated that 1,202 men had refused to crack stone. This represents almost two-thirds of the men who were being required to break stone for their relief. This is very, very important in terms of understanding what was going on. In the second week of January 1896, John Curry and Thomas Wilson were charged with vagrancy after having refused to break stone at the House of Industry. When the two men appeared in front of the magistrate on January 10th, the two tramps who were said to have preferred jail to breaking stone were given 3 months in jail. You can see, again, a kind of resistance that is beginning. A month later, City Alderman Jollylife introduced a motion which made it mandatory for all able-bodied applicants applying for outdoor relief to break a yard of stone, break double the amount of stone for their relief. A few days later, Tony Unemployed protested in front of City Hall. An identified unemployed man, which Toronto Star doesn't identify, said this. And I remember coming across this the first time when I came across this quote and being very struck again in terms of a response. And this is what the man said. He says, "And they calls that charity, do they? Got to crack a heap of stone for what you get? Ain't no charity in that, as I can see." Again, showing a very, very real consciousness around what was going on during that period, and despite the extreme discrimination and prejudice that exists. On May 16th, 1896, a Toronto Star editorial, which was simply entitled "The Labor Test," reinforced all the rationale for making the mandatory labor test in Toronto for Toronto's poor and those who found themselves out of work. And this is the editorial that appeared. And again, this kind of material is there often as the labor test is reinforced throughout a long period of time. "If ye work not, neither shall ye eat," has as a dictum the sanction of the Holy Writ. Nothing can be more demoralizing than giving alms to men who are quite able to work, but very unwilling. At the instance of Alderman Jolliffe, then a manager of the House of Industry, one of the most costly and important Toronto charities, obtained from the City Council a large quantity of stone with the intention of having it broken by the casuals who resort thither for outdoor and indoor relief. The complaints of these people generally is that they can find no work to do and are therefore forced to beg. The truth is that very few of them are willing to work, while all are willing to depend on the charity for their living. And then goes on to say, "The best tonic for them is a strong daily dose of hard manual labor with the threat of starvation on one hand and the inducement of decent living on the other." On December 21, 1897, the Toronto Star reported that in the past 4 days, some 60 tramps had refused to crack stones. One of the men seeking relief was said to have told the magistrate that he would rather steal than break stone. Again, signs of some kind of resistance and movement. 13 years later, after the House of Industry introduced its new mandatory work tests, Superintendent Langlin had this to say about the work tests that they introduced over a decade ago. Again, they were struggling in terms of having to deal with the people who were coming for relief. He says, "We were able to handle all the poor in of the city on the basis of the work tests. The stone is drawn to the yard in the rear of the House of Industry by contractors. It comes chiefly from farmlands and from the lake, and when broken, is carted away by the city to the roadways where construction work is being carried out. Our work test is a splendid thing and tends to keep down the number of applicants for help to a minimum. Well, you see, we were the victims of considerable imposition during the Depression about 14 years ago when the unemployed carried the black flag." Langlin here is giving us a big, big clue in terms of what was happening in 1891. And there are records of unemployed, up to 1,000 people, two demonstrations, carrying a black flag that said bread or wages. And they were very concerned about this resistance. And he's telling us that it was there. He says, "We then decided to establish the stone yard," because they were concerned about this movement. "And before we could get relief to each able-bodied, he had to break 2 yards of stone. This innovation was pronounced a success, and the application for relief began to fall off at a rapid rate until we had very few families to take care of. Again, you can see that the work test was met solely as a deterrence. A year later, January 16th, 1909, the unemployed are again rebelling against the mandatory labor tests. We're talking now almost, we're at almost 14, 15 years of unemployed having to crack stone for their relief. That morning, on January 16th, 45 men ate breakfast and left the house industry without doing the required labor tests. 2 days later, another 40 men who ate breakfast refused to crack stone because of extreme cold weather. Again, we can see this kind of consciousness and resistance that exists. These examples are kind of fragmented as we go through the period, but they do give us a kind of a very different picture that we would get from let's say Langdon or Golden Smith or the other people. Around that time, there were large unemployed demonstrations, and sometimes up to 1,000 people. I remember reading about two of them. After one of these demonstrations, on the morning of January 21st, 1909, 1,000 unemployed men gathered at St. Andrew's Hall and to discuss demands. One of the people who spoke, his name is Ernest Drury, addressed a crowd. And he says, "I advise you men to go there, the House of Industry, not with the intention of breaking stone, but of stealing a loaf of bread." So interesting that this is the tone of that meeting. The people are very rebelling, and although the reclamation to abolish the labor test didn't come until much later. Again, to give you a kind of different perspective in terms of an unemployed perspective, about what they thought of the whole thing and how it worked. So a month after this meeting at St. Drew's Hall on February 15, 1909, the Toronto Star published the following letter. The letter is titled, Brutal Treatment of the Unemployed. Though the city claims to be very religious, you have a savage way of treating poor fellows that have nowhere to go. The statement that some of the men refuse to work has appeared in the whole Canadian press from the Atlantic to the Pacific. But nobody ever asks why such a large percentage of men refuse to work. No, they are simply put down as lazy. Now, when a man goes to the place like the House of Industry, it is plain that he is half starved already. There, he gets bread and some warm water, called tea, at night and in the morning. Most likely, he will not get a bed for the first three nights, but will sleep on the floor. With hardly any room to turn. When he gets up in the morning, after what little sleep he has been able to get, he is required to break a lot of stones. The quantity of stones to be broken will take a man used to it 3 hours, but a man who is not used to this kind of work will take 4 to 6 hours. Six hours hard work for a bit of dry bread and a rest on the floor. And we sing, "Britons shall never be slaves." Let the people of Toronto reflect a little on the conditions of the city and this city and cease casting upon those who are at the time being in bad circumstances. The letter is signed, "Out of Work." It's clear from this letter that this person was through the house industry, that lived there. It's the details that are given. A year later, on Tuesday, February 8th, 1910, 7 men from the non-stone-breaking union appeared in court in front of Magistrate Hills. Their names were listed as Alfred Lawson, John Oakley, Joseph McGovern, George Wright, George Thompson, Richard Hamilton, and Sidney Alexander. All 7 were charged with vagrancy after they had refused to break stone at the House of Industry. The superintendent from the House of Industry gave testimony at the trial against the 7 men. "He, Lawson, was just playing with the whole thing," the superintendent testified. "Lawson wouldn't break 8 ounces of stone in 8 hours. The superintendent added, "Sidney Alexander refused to even go out to the yard and look at the pile of stone." The superintendent complained that, to the magistrate, that the men spend their money in the outside of the town and then come back to Toronto in droves and expect to be kept. All of the men were found guilty of vagrancy, and sentencing the magistrate, Ellis told the unemployed that he would give them a chance to do real work, and they were sentenced to jail. 5 years later, again, in one of the courts in Toronto, on February 5th, 1915, George Buss, a 35-year-old Englishman who had been in Canada for 7 years, appeared in court in front of Squire Ellis on charges of vagrancy. Also charged with Buss was Nicol Melasson. Constable McBurney testified that Buss, who was single, was arrested after refusing to crack stone for meals he was receiving at the House of Industry. This is from the Star. Constable Burney stated in prosecution that Buss had been getting his meals free at the House of Industry and had refused to work for them, that is, crack stone. That is correct, said Buss in a defiant air. Oh, I see, you are one of those who has come to the conclusion that somebody should support you, the squire said. Oh, yes, said Buss. Did you refuse to crack stone for your meals? Yes, and there were lots like me. And you sleep at police stations? Yes, with hundreds of others. Have you hunted for work? I certainly have. Yet you refuse to work for your food? That's one way of looking at it. Your way, said Buss. Well, I think you need looking after, said the worship, and sentenced him to 90 days in jail. This is probably, for me, one of the most important passages in terms of understanding this resistance. I won't go through it now because I want to talk about this stuff. But if you begin to analyze what Buss is saying here, it's clear that there's a movement. He might have been one of the leaders of people who were organizing against this. It's hard to tell from this. But it's clear, and also is very, very defiant in court, much more defiant than we were ever in court. Like Peter, no? I want to end this section by two quick things. In 1915, a year after the First World War began, Toronto police reported that 10,569 people were provided shelter in police stations. It was common practice back then to have people could seek shelter in police stations, and that's what the Buss is referring to. The following year, a mere 368 people received shelter at stations. They'd all gone to war. These people, this extreme prejudice and discrimination that had been, they weren't good enough for some stuff, but when it came time to fight a war, they were very useful. And by 1925, the police cells were filled again with the unemployed and the homeless seeking shelter. A record 16,488 homeless people were given shelter in the police stations that year, many of them ex-soldiers. Again, to give you a sense of what was going on. One of the first examples that I saw of the unemployed actually demanding that the labor tests be abolished was in the spring of 1930. The day before this delegation went to City Hall, there were 2,000 unemployed demonstrated on Bay Street in front of City Hall around, I think it was a day of action, International Day of Action Against Unemployment. And there was a big battle. They were pushed back. People were fought back. 11 people were arrested, including one woman, and two people who actually were homeless. But the next day, a delegation went to City Hall, and these were the demands that they were asking for. They demanded trade union wages, relief paid in cash, the abolition of the work tests, a reduction in the work week, and that unemployed have representatives on all the relief committees. The issue of labor tests or forced labor was central throughout the 1930s, throughout the Great Depression. And there were many other kinds of battles. So I'm now going to turn my attention to the York 1936 York relief strike and try and take you through that. But I want to set the context before I go through that. How are we doing for time? We're okay? I just don't know where. I just got to get
quarter to four.
Quarter to four. Okay. So maybe we'll get through this one and then we'll. In February of 1935, Hepburn government cut relief by 10%, and that set off a chain of events. So that by the spring of 1935, there were occupations of relief offices. So in New Toronto, for instance, the unemployed there took over a relief office for 2 days, and after that marched across the street and took over a jail for almost 25 hours, I think it was, and demanding that the relief be returned. And 11 people were arrested as a result of that action. At the beginning of April, there was a large suburban march that involved, I think, something like 10 or 12 communities of workers' associations that marched on Queen's Park. And one of the demands was that they address the legislatures. So that when they got there was actually a big fence in front of them, and they were actually received by Hepburn. But what happened before is quite significant in terms of understanding the tension that was that existed when the march happened. A week earlier, specifically on the afternoon of March 28, 1935, a delegation of 9 people, 2 of them women, representing the York unemployed, visited the relief officer, relief officer R.G. Geggy at the Rogers Road relief office in York. The delegation demanded an end to evictions and the restoration of relief cuts. 700 unemployed rallied outside the relief building while the meeting was taking place. During the 1 hour meeting, Greggy phoned Queen's Park and was instructed to take down the unemployed, the unemployed's complaints in writing and forward them to the government. The delegation, not satisfied with this response, informed the relief officer that they would not leave until their demands were met. Inspector Nash, who was present during the negotiation, ordered the delegation to leave. 2 of the unemployed refused. He physically removed them. Once outside, leaders of the delegation addressed the massive crowd who were waiting to hear the result of the meeting. When the crowd was told that the government had refused to meet their demands, the unemployed stormed the building. Police intervened with batons, and the unemployed responded by throwing rocks and bottles. Several windows of the relief buildings were broken. Over the next 2 hours, unemployed fought hand-to-hand combat with the police. On several occasions, police with batons in hand charged the crowd, which now had grown to more than 1,000 people. The unemployed openly resisted the police baton charges, resisted the baton charges, and refused to disperse. Several police officers were injured, along with numerous demonstrators as a result. This is an account from the Star of what happened that night. Enraged at the deputation's report, the crowd made a concerted rush on the building, hurling rocks and bottles through the windows and showering the occupants with glass. Urged by women, they made the rush to the side door, smashing it in while the glass continued to fly in all directions. Police drew their batons and fought with the men through the shattered doors, preventing them from gaining entrance. Riot squads arrived from the headquarters and charged the crowd, driving them along Rogers Road and down the street. A group of youth blocked the path of the police, and a free-for-all followed, in which police wielded their batons, and the youth hurled stones and bottles and wielded fists. Small fights waged along the streets. Several fights raged on verandas and nearby homes. Shortly after 6 o'clock, the crowd reformed and was addressed by someone. So you can see this image. This is in a neighborhood, and this is going on, and fights going on verandas. This is huge, huge stuff. 1,000 people. It was a very important event in terms of what happened. And the reason I want to talk about that first is because I want to kind of stress that the York Unemployed were a very militant organization, maybe the most militant in terms of what they would do. So I'm going to turn now to the York relief strike, which happened in 1936. In the spring of 1936, the Hepburn government cut relief to their unemployed again by 10%, and also cut single unemployed, and also single unemployed were cut from relief entirely. On Monday, June 1st, 50 York relief workers refused to collect garbage. Their actions marked the beginning of the relief strike in York. The following day, the strike was in full swing, and all relief work sites in the township were picketed. 3,600 heads of families in York were now on strike. We're going to stop every bit of work in the township if we can, warned Ewart Humphreys, who's one of the leaders of the strike. Ms. Humphreys' wife said, "You'll have more to contend with the women than you will with the men. The women aren't going to stand for it." And she proved to be true to her words, so we'll see. As soon as the strike began, Geggy, the relief officer, warned that those who refused to work would be classed as unemployable and would have their relief cut by another 10%, and would be issued vouchers instead of relief cash. I'm just stop for a second here. There were huge battles around, for cash relief for the unemployed to get cash relief. When relief strikes happen, often they were actually cut off relief. And I won't go through that. If people want to talk a bit more about that, during the talk, I don't have time right now. But one of the tactics that the municipalities and the government used was just to cut people off completely, and that meant starving the children, right, and the wives. Everybody would starve and would suffer. Not all municipalities did that, but that's what. York Single Unemployed set up a camp. After hearing that the municipality was going to do this, York Unemployed held a mass meeting of that night in each of the three York wards. 1,000 unemployed attended the meetings and voted to strike to the finish, despite Geggy's threat. The York Single Unemployed man set up a camp on a vacant lot to protest and demand that they be reinstated on the rolls. The encampment, which housed 25 single unemployed and fed 40, became known as the Red Square or Kroll Village. During this period, an important development was occurring in the Lakeshore District. In New Toronto, a meeting was being planned for June 9th, where unemployed from Mimico, Alderwood, Humber Bay, Lakeview, and Long Branch were to make a decision about going on strike in sympathy with York strikers, who had been on strike since June 2nd. Clergy were also supporting them during that period. On Wednesday, June 9th, North York unemployed went on strike in sympathy with relief strikers in York. All township projects were picketed. North York Council immediately cut strikers' relief by 10%. 400 families were affected. In York, the York Township unemployed women who refused to watch their families starve held a mass meeting at Red Square. At that meeting, the women announced that they were intending to storm the relief office and demand the restoration of the relief cuts. When we go on the war path, we force attention, and nothing brings these men to come to time so quickly as a crowd of angry women, Ms. McGregor, chairman of the meeting, told the crowd. We haven't any food left in the house, and we will keep on powering. And they will keep on powering us until we starve, unless we show fight. We told relief officer to expect us, and tomorrow we hope to have a showdown. The following day, on Wednesday, June the 24th, York women arrived at the relief office with baby carriages and stormed the relief office. They blocked the doors and refused to let Geggy go until their demands were met. The women sat down and warned that unless their demands were met, they were prepared to stay on the night if necessary. Over the next 2 hours, their husbands and other members of the workers' association brought large cauldrons of soup and sandwiches to the women. The standoff ended 2 hours later when Reeve Magwood negotiated with the women and authorized Geggy to issue emergency relief vouchers for 2 days for those families without food. Concerned about the safety of the relief staff, York Council later voted to station a police officer at the relief office to avoid further disturbance. This will become significant in a second. On Monday, June 29th, 7 municipalities from the Lakeshore District voted to strike in support of the York. They included Lakeview, 200 families, Mimico, 300 families, Humber Bay, West Mountain, and Alderwood, 300 families. There were now almost 5,000 families affected by the strike in 9 Toronto suburbs. 2 other Lakeshore districts, municipalities, Long Branch and New Toronto, had yet to vote on whether to join the strike. Long Branch would vote to join the strike a few days later. New Toronto, not the only municipality not to join the strike. I'm going to skip a section here which talks about what happened in those municipalities in terms of the reaction. Many of the workers were actually cut off relief immediately in some of those municipalities. Others, municipalities actually supported them and didn't cut off at all. By July 6th, the York Relief Strike was in its fifth week. There were now 10 suburban municipalities on strike. More than 5,000 families were affected by the general strike. And the Toronto suburban unemployment movement was threatening to spread in other municipalities across the province. Now, just so you understand, 5,000 families, if you include, that's heads of families, if you include the women, that's 10,000. If you average, maybe they had large families, four kids, you're talking about, what, 40, 50,000 people affected by this strike in this area. On Monday, July 6th, on one of the hottest days of the year, actually it was 102 degrees, 2,000 York unemployed rallied at Bloom Avenue and Dufferin Street. They marched to the relief office, which was a block away. When the crowd arrived in the early afternoon, a lone officer was guarding the front door of the building, that officer who got assigned there a week earlier. The large crowd, led by a group of 50 women, stormed the building. A chaotic scene ensued when the officer pulled his baton and struck some of the women in an attempt to prevent them from reaching the relief office on the second floor. Angered by the officer's action, the women quickly overpowered the officers and chased them up the stairs. When the officer retreated behind the door of the relief office, the women tore the door off its hinges and began the siege. They refused to let the relief officer Geggy and 13 of his assistants leave. And Geggy was held in one of the rooms by the women. There's a wonderful picture, actually, of the two relief officers in the back and about a group of about 10 women that are facing the camera as this is going on. This is the star account of the beginnings of this occupation. Led by several women with crying babies clutched in their arms, the crowd defied the officer's threatening baton and forced him to beat a quick retreat up the stairs. Halfway up the stairs, after some of the women had squeezed under his outreach arms, the officer beat at the outstanding mob, but was finally overpowered. "Get him!" screamed several of the women of the crowd as they surged after the officer when he retreated behind the office doors on the second floor. Breaking down the doors, several of the crowd picked up chairs and hurled them at the officer and warded them off with their hands. And then when police reinforcement arrived, again, there was a bit of a struggle, a bit of a fight, and people fought a bit, and they were enraged by this. But then eventually things settled down. And after the initial clash with police officers, things calmed down. The demonstration took on a more festive atmosphere, and large crowd of employees and sympathizers gathered outside the building, which by early afternoon had grown to almost 4,000 people. So this is like early evening, you're watching this thing develop. At the same time that the women laid, we'll leave that. Around that time, in the early evening, a group of North York women arrived at the York occupation and announced that they had won provision for special relief vouchers for $1.50 to be issued to striking relief families in North York. The women had attended a North York council meeting in the afternoon, blocked the exits, and had refused to allow councillors to leave until they were provided with an emergency voucher. This is an account of that event. The chambers were so thronged by unemployed who insisted that their demands be heard. All exits were closely guarded, and one of the leaders addressing the members of the council shouted, "We'll keep you here until you give us something to eat." Pleading with the strikers not to do anything rash, Reeve Bales made several unsuccessful attempts to pass through a cordon of women who locked arms and barricaded all exits. Held prisoners in their own assembly room, the councillors entered into a frank discussion with the strikers' leaders who were intent that they would not withdraw until some concessions were secured. Finally, it was agreed that emergency vouchers would be given. What happened, I'll just paraphrase here, I won't read from this, is that subsequently the Reeve came to the relief office and they refused to let him go also. Eventually, they forced council to come to the relief office, and after just before midnight, council agreed to all of the demands of the unemployed, York unemployed. 2 days later, Etobicoke unemployed also did a similar action. They held Reeve Armstrong and relief officer Grubb prisoner for almost 28 hours in a school boiler room. Again, similarly held them until the demands were met. In that particular incident, it was interesting because they were actually supported by truckloads of unemployed workers from Lakeshore District who were coming. So that by the time the cops came at noon, they were threatening to evict them. There were over 1,000 people waiting there, and eventually they came to an understanding. What happened after these occupation and these strikes, it was that Premier Hepburn ordered the arrest or issued warrants for the leaders of these two workers' associations. So there was two midnight raids. The first one on July 10th, where I think it was 11 people arrested. The following night, 17 people arrested. Not one single woman was charged in this incident. Okay, I'm going to stop there because I think I'm almost at my time here and stuff. If there's time a little bit after, we can talk a little bit about some of the eviction stuff that I have. But I just want to end by going back to this quote that I started with in terms of the stuff that we just looked at. On June 15th, 2000, some of us attended a demonstration which has become known as the Queen's Park Riots. 1,500 people marched from Allen Gardens and demanded to address the legislature. And when the delegation was refused, a confrontation, a very violent confrontation occurred, which lasted about 45 minutes. Many people were hurt, policemen, demonstrators, during that period. One of the things that I remember really that struck me that I read the next day in the newspaper is that Gerard Kennedy had come out during the confrontation and was walking and giving interviews. And one of the things that he said was that the poor that he knew suffered in silence. The implication being that the people who were there were not poor, or that, you know, the people, if they were poor, they weren't deserving. That always stayed with me, and I want to end with that quote in the context of William Dawson's words, which I began with at the beginning of the talk. I realized the first time that I read those words, you know, which is, I think, 5-6 years ago, William Dawson's word, that they were very dangerous words. That these were words in a history that by some would need to be suppressed. And I wonder today if William Dawson was sitting here, what he would think, right? That 3,000 miles away, 200 years later, you know, we have his words that we can connect to our struggle. And I'll end by saying that these words, in my opinion, and this history that we part of it we heard, are especially dangerous given the times we live in. Fair enough. Times of austerity. And we're watching what's happening in Europe and other countries. And I think there are historically powers that be that have a vested interest in suppressing this history, precisely because of what it means to someone like me, for instance, finding out that, you know, William Dawson, you know, George Buss, Erwin Humphreys, that somehow those people did struggle, that people, there was a history there, that people did not accept the status quo, that's discrimination that exists today, and that prejudice that exists today around beggars and poor people, that there were people who always, always knew that was wrong. So I'll stop it. Okay? have a small discussion or people have questions or... Oh, people are back, okay. Yeah.
Were any unions at that time joining the women and others who were the unemployed who were protesting?
There was any
collective action?
There is some support. There's evidence in Toronto. I didn't talk about this at all, but part of the research I did is around unemployed organizing in hostels during the 1930s, and there were meetings at the labor board around these kinds of issues, and they did support. One of the demands for the single unemployed was that they be given a cash voucher or cash relief, so they actually called for the abolishment of hostels, so that the men could actually get money to rent rooms. Otherwise, they were just stuck there. So there was a lot of support that way. There was some support later on also in terms of, because a lot of the relief work that was being done, it was municipal work that was traditionally done by people who were receiving wages. And there was opposition to the fact that they were forcing people. So there was some of that, but not as much as I you'd want. Yeah, I got David then.
I think most of that took place, though, in Oshawa, Oakville, Windsor, because at that point it was the organizing of the auto workers.
Yeah.
And it was the CIO organizing. What the combo was that the union organizers would stop the eviction of the unemployed, and the unemployed would not scab on the organizing drives. So that there was lots of evidence of that, and it may not have been Oakville. But it was the CIO drive that actually encouraged the most of that kind of combination. I was just going to say on the relief work, because again, the Black Flag demos in the 1890s started the relief work out of City Hall.
Yep.
And actually they created a lot of the municipal work that the union then came later.
Okay.
So I actually think it went the other way around. The unemployed actually created, some of that work continued. I did some of that work in the 60s and the 70s because it was still there for unemployed. Do snow clearance and other work by the 70s that was still there from that mobilization.
I think for me, this research raised that I haven't talked about, we haven't talked about, is this whole notion of the role of the unemployed in class, you know, class movements, you know, a working class movement. And I think for me, what this raises is that it has at times been ignored. But it's clear that they played a central role. And the argument in the paper by Brian is that, as a matter of fact, is that the labor and the unemployed, because so many people now are unemployed or underemployed, that they will play a major role in terms of fighting back around. No.
I'm assuming that prison or jail was more harsh than the House of Industry. Which, in some way, does that indicate that these people were so proud, the poor were so proud, that when they would rather go to jail than be trod upon by the charity, religious-minded people of the city?
Yeah, that whole question, for me, is a really big question in terms of the whole issue of charity and people. And it's one I struggle with in terms of why we, as poor people, should be too proud to receive charity. And I think that buys into a whole ideology that for me, that works with the status quo, that we should feel that way, that they want us to feel that way. And because by doing that, then the whole notion that we have a right to all of these things becomes kind of, you know, mixed and stuff, right? Because, I mean, George Buss, when he went in front of one of the things that was clear for him, was that he had a right to these things. And that guy who said, you know, charity, you call this charity? You know, so that whole debate of you know, that we as poor people who've gone through poverty, of being grateful and being too proud to go, and, you know, and but the truth is, you know what? You know, it can happen to any of us, right? That if we, we're in the process of, many countries are in the process of losing their social programs. And I'll tell you right now, if you become unemployed without unemployment insurance, if you would have, that came out of those struggles. If you get sick and you don't have health care, all of those things, you're dead in the water. Right? Yeah. Yeah. Yeah.
It's amazing that you've done this research and to see all the processes of like criminalization of poor people, like people that have, like you said, like find themselves in a tough situation, and then that situation itself is criminalized, or their behavior is criminalized to make it worse and worse and worse. And you said that there was, you mentioned this interesting thing that, I can't remember the figure, but there were like something like 10,000 people seeking shelter in like jails 1 year, and then 200 the next year because of the First World War.
Yeah.
It made me wonder if like conscription is another means of like criminalizing poor people. And so were people enlisted in the First World War as conscription, or did people sign up? Because
other people would know better than me. Maybe David knows, but I...
They had to conscript because there was so much opposition, not just in Quebec, but across English Canada. There were people, organizers against it. Ginger Goodwin in BC was murdered by the RCMP for organizing miners against conscription. So at that point, English Canada and Quebec were both fighting against being sent to an English war, is what they called it. Mm-hmm. Or at least a boss's war, because there was all sorts of both class components and...
There was conscription.
A sense that it was an English war.
Mm-hmm. That's one of the reasons why some people signed up.
Mike?
Not on the side.
Okay. Just a quick note. There's a really, really fascinating strike that happened outside of Toronto in Crolin, just outside of Welland, that happened at the same time that the large suburban march was happening. And it was very, very significant because it had a number of components to it. It had a man, I forget his name now, who was a communist, who's a leader, and a Tom Martin, I think is his name, was CCF. They led the march. Also, it was largely immigrant workers that were on relief, that they were organizing. And it was very significant because from the get-go, they were cut off relief. They had no food. They lasted 5 to 6 weeks. They took their kids out of school and sent them to Toronto, and they were supported by Toronto. So there was a fascinating, fascinating relief strike in terms of, the struggle. It was actually Hepburn actually came to Crolin on 2 to 3 occasions and eventually quashed the strike. Sorry, Mark?
I was thinking earlier about in terms of the prejudices and the attitudes which have unfortunately barely been buried under the surface and possibly are reappearing in these times as we hear about places in the States that are making it actually illegal to feed homeless people in certain American cities.
I have to just pick up on Mark's point that these prejudice and discrimination continues today. But I remember as I was reading this, and I'll tell you what the difference is somewhat as I read this stuff. I found that the material, that they were much more open about their discrimination and their prejudices, and that people like Gerard Kennedy, who would argue that they're poor, suffer in silence, much more sophisticated in terms of how and the likes. I don't want to pick up George Kennedy, but there's others like him. And it's much more sophisticated. Although I think we go through periods where because the movement is not strong, where the city has a number of groups who openly, go after poor people. Yeah. Alex?
Yeah. I know, I'm just to build on that. I mean, I know that a lot of the discourse in the United States where they've actually passed these laws have to do with either the idea that you could poison people or recently, I was just actually reading in New York, even actually people who have been displaced and made homeless by this hurricane have actually been, there's been people, they've been told that it's illegal to actually donate food because of the concentration of salt or trans fats that actually might be in it, that they've passed like these health sort of bylaws. So that's what they're basically saying. So they've got all these people that are lined up and they don't actually have enough food for them, but they're still actually denying people with the really good Samaritans to actually help out their fellow neighbors.
Any other? Yeah, Kenny?
Wondering about the rock pond location or whatever, and you're supposed to create a rock pile. There's no rock pile. Then what? I think in terms of nowadays called wood fairing, there really is no work. There's no.
Yeah. Well,
it's a whole. It's all ambiguous is what I'm getting at. But then it was there's that rock pile breaking, right? So
it's clearer to you. Yeah. No, it's a good point.
More of a mirage.
Yeah, no, it's clear to you that that's a good point, but I'm sure you're not advocating for a work pile. More clarity. Yeah. Yeah. So are we, people don't have any more questions, we can, okay. What time is it? 4:14. Yeah.
Just curious, around this time, as some of us know, it was the march to Ottawa, the On to Ottawa from BC.
Yeah.
There was TV and video on this very, very, a documentary. I wonder if any of the organizers at that time knew about this, and it was from the relief camp. It was to protest the relief camps.
Oh, they knew.
As you know.
Not only did they know.
And they were playing on the tops of the train. You saw workers from the relief camps right on top of the trains on freight trains going to Ottawa from B.C., and then they were shot by the RCMP, as we know, in Saskatchewan. But I wonder if some of the organizers with the Stone and Cap, later, the organizers in 35 in Toronto knew about it.
Ewart Humphreys, who was the main leader in the York, one of the main leaders in other, led the, after it was the Regina March, they were shut down in Regina, Ewart Humphreys led the Toronto March to Ottawa. There was a large, about 500 people marched from Toronto to Ottawa. Ewart Humphreys was a guy. So, yeah, so he led that. I'm going to end then one short story, and then then we'll leave it at that, and then people can, since we didn't talk about evictions, this was probably one of my favorite stories, if I can find it really quickly here. Take me a second and then go. Yeah. Oh, so it was published in the which this covers the period up until 1930, and some of this material in Labour le Travail, the actual title of the paper I have to look it up. That's not good. Cracking the Stone: The Long History of Capitalism Crisis and Toronto's Dispossessed, and again. This paper was done with myself and Brian, and I think had Brian been here, I think we would have touched on other aspects of it that are actually fascinating and stuff. So I want to end with one last story.
How can it be gone? How can that book be gone?
You know what? I'll get your copy. I'll get your copy. I'll email you a copy.
No, get Don a copy.
Okay, I'll get Don. As I was doing this research, the question of women often comes up. And it's actually fascinating in terms of there's one particular incident that I haven't talked about, which I'm not going to talk about, but the Lakeview in 1938, there was a group of women who held an officer hostage for I think 5 hours outside the relief office while about 400 or 500 unemployed were watching, demanding relief. And there's a wonderful picture of some women sitting on the car. And it was cold that night, and then there was 4 women inside. And subsequently, they were arrested and charged along with 4 other men. And it was a big, big trial. And I didn't talk about that one, but it's one of those very few examples. There's also some interesting stuff around unemployed women who were getting cash relief, single women, and their relief was cut off, and there was some really interesting stuff around that. But I want to just end with a very short account of an eviction that was stopped in Toronto, actually. I think it might have been by Spadina and Queen, from what I can tell. I'm not 100% sure. On June 1st, 1933, Miss Miksha, 31, who lived with her husband, was alone in her home with two of her children when bailiffs arrived to enforce an eviction notice. The Miksha's had missed a rent payment. When women in the neighborhood saw the bailiffs enter Miksha's home, they immediately came to her defense. Miss Miksha and the neighborhood women recounted to the Star Report what happened that afternoon. Miss Miksha: "The bailiffs came to the door and ordered me to get my furniture out of the house. I said, 'You can't move me. I'm sick.' Then I locked the door. A bailiff broke the window and grabbed my key, which hung from the string on the back of the door. Inside, they ordered me to take all of my furniture out and pile it in the backyard. I refused. The first object the bailiffs wanted to carry out was the baby carriage. I couldn't let them do that. I will need that very soon." It's very practical. That was the worst thing they could have done, to start with the baby carriage. I will not soon. Two took my dining room out the table, out the backyard. I locked the back door, and then while they were outside, the bailiff still inside grabbed the key out of my hands, and after a struggle, and let them in. This is the women picking up the story. "When we saw the bailiffs go into Ms. Miksha's house, we went right across to help her. We knew she was very sick and she should not be moved. Four of the women entered together and made for the sheriff, who had been struggling with Ms. Miksha. We pulled his hair, punched him, scratched him, hit him, throwing him out the door, and the third beat it." It's not very good to tell that to, right? If I was a lawyer, I was. A group of unemployed men soon showed up and helped the women throw the bailiff out the door. Yesterday, bailiffs evicted a family on this street. The leader of the unemployed stated, "In 15 minutes, we had 300 men, and they were moved the furniture back in, just like it was. That's what we intend to do every time." 40 Toronto unemployed stood guard on Miksha's home the next day. A message written in crayon on a piece of cardboard was placed in the window. It read, "The Toronto Council of Unemployed will fight eviction cases." A spokesperson for the group warned, just let them, the bailiffs, dare to come back. The bailiffs will get worse than they got the first time. We don't like bailiffs here. So I just thought it was a really interesting story. Okay.